Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Sorry for a little bit of a delay, I think, since after Halloween. It feels like for the first time in a while, we've actually had a busy week, a busy-ish week.
Well, we had Halloween and then...
We actually did something with the cousins, or with some of the cousins for Halloween too. And I helped with a baby shower and it would just... I don't know.
Election night,
though we had voted early, we didn't.
It was up entirely too late to find out nothing.
Yeah. So it's felt a little busier, which is kind of nice in a way because COVID slowed us down to where it was like, yeah, we're just at home all the time.
Yeah.
We've had a good, fun week. Sadie was Minnie Mouse, and Caleb was Luigi, and he had the mustache and everything, and so that was all great, and we have entirely too much candy now.
I ate a lot right after dinner today, which I was not happy. I'm not happy with myself.
We have way too much. We honestly need to, like, throw away some of it or something.
It's the Reese's, to me. Anything peanut butter chocolate-based is just the thing.
Yeah.
I cannot help myself with peanut butter chocolate things.
Yeah.
Like when you do Muddy Buddies, I can't help myself.
I know. I'm really bad about it. That's why I haven't made them in a while, is because it's like I'm like guaranteed to gain like 2 pounds.
Well, and now we're entering into Thanksgiving season, which I've been begging for some Chex Mix, you know, so I would love some Chex Mix.
Wink, wink.
If anybody has any. I would love some.
Yeah.
You're starting to get into like, different random side things that stay on the counter for a long time.
You
just eat. And then as you roll into Christmas time, which you've already started Christmas, basically.
Sort of.
Which is incredibly annoying to me.
I kind of combined Thanksgiving and Christmas just because, like, we start decorating for Christmas at Thanksgiving, and that's part of why I like Thanksgiving. Is just kind of like, I love the meal, I love being with family.
And you love Thanksgiving because of what it means to you for Christmas, and that's so frustrating.
That is such a misuse
of the holiday, and I draw the hard line at the decorations.
We are not decorating before Thanksgiving. I'm pretty good about that. Well, not before. I mean,
She's got Christmas music on the radio every time we get in the car. And so I never leave the house anyways. And so then whenever I do leave the house, it's Christmas music.
Guys, he secretly loves it because he was like, why don't you try to find a Christmas station on Sirius?
I'm trying to think of her. And I know that she loves Christmas music. And so, like, Rand Collective's got a... Which we need to buy that album.
I think we got it last year, actually.
Did we?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Well, either way, we'll have to, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we need to... No, it came out this year.
Oh.
This Ring Collective, I think it just came out.
They got a new one.
Yeah, but anyway, so Ring Collective came out, and I was like, hey, you should get that. But that was not at all in me endorsing Christmas before Thanksgiving. I'm just very touchy about I love Thanksgiving.
Look, I usually wait a little longer than this, probably till like midway through November, but this year with everything, I just needed some extra joy, so here we are.
Yeah. So to start out today, Melissa had the great idea of telling an embarrassing story, and I said, that's a great idea, Melissa. You should tell an embarrassing story, because she had in mind, I think embarrassing stories for me.
Oh, I already had one picked out.
She had one picked out for me as to one that I should tell. So maybe I will tell that next week. Instead, I'm going to push it off onto her.
Yeah, and it's say just you gonna be me this week.
Should tell an embarrassing story before we get into Exodus 16. So yeah, what is your embarrassing story that you want to tell?
So this week, well, I guess to preface all this, in premarital counseling, Garrett and I had
premarital counseling is your embarrassing story?
Hold on. That's not okay. The embarrassing story. It's okay. Just this, you got to have this background.
Okay.
Garrett and I had decided that Garrett would mow the yard.
So it's not actually it's not actually an embarrassing story. You're just outing me. That's what's happening. You said that you're basically saying there was an agreement made. Okay, go ahead.
Well,
you're just outing me here. That's
all. This is just the why I've only mowed twice in our marriage, okay?
Okay.
So I've only mowed twice in our marriage, and it's not because, it's because we agreed that Garrett would always mow. And I'd say out of almost 9 years, me mowing twice makes you look pretty good.
Sure, okay.
Wouldn't you say?
Maybe.
But I have mowed twice. And the second time was this past week.
It's like, you did not agree. You did not meet the marriage requirements for what we agreed to. I'm out. Yeah, okay.
So this past week was the second time that I have mowed in our marriage. And our yard is really small. It takes like 30 minutes to mow. It's like all flat. We use a push mower. Our push mower is not self-propelled. So that makes it a little tougher, but we went for a cheap mower.
Mm-hmm. We have a tiny yard. Because, yeah.
Exactly. There's no point in getting like some sort of like, can you imagine if we had like a zero turn?
Riding lawnmower. Yeah, zero turn mower, and I'm like done in a minute.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know where we would store that. But anyways, so I was mowing. Garrett's had kind of a stressful little bit at work, so I thought I would, you know, try to help him out with that. And Caleb saw me mowing, and he was like, "Mom, what are you doing? You're going to hurt yourself." And
you should not be mowing. You are going to hurt yourself.
And I couldn't even disagree with him, because the first time that I had mowed, I had, when I was starting the mower, you know, remember, it's a push mower, so you got to, like, you know,
really pull hard.
Really pull it.
Yeah.
I had pinched a nerve in my back.
She mowed one time.
I mowed the first time I mowed, yeah. Which is probably why it was like a year in between, year and a half in between when I mowed. I pinched a nerve in my back, and like the next night I woke up with my entire right side, well, I say entire right side, from like my hip down to my, you know, ankle, was numb. And I woke up in the middle of the night realizing something fell off. I stood up and immediately fell to the ground, which was terrifying at the time. Like, I was dealing with anxiety already, and then add on like a numb leg, and you're just like, oh my goodness, what's going on? And so that pinched nerve in my upper back from starting the lawnmower is what caused my entire leg to go numb. And I ended up in physical therapy. Like, literally at the physical therapy with all these much older people who are working on, you know, their hip issues and knee issues and stuff. And so, I mean, I just wanted to say to Caleb, yeah, you're right. You know, last time I mowed, I ended up in physical therapy.
which should get, you know, it should have made it so that you had some sympathy for me, because I don't like to mow the grass either. And, you know, I mean, I put my life on the line every single time I mow, because just like you said,
you could get injured at any moment. To end up in physical therapy because of mowing.
Yeah. So every time I mow, I'm putting my life, my very well-being.
Do you know how embarrassing it is to be like at the doctor's office and be like, well, you know, I did mow the other day.
What have you done lately? I did mow the grass.
I did start the lawnmower the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is my embarrassing story, and it kind of came to surface again this week when Caleb asked me that question. And Caleb didn't know about the last, like, he does not, like, put together that I got hurt the first time. So He is purely like, isn't that what dad does? You're going to hurt yourself, kind of. We've got to teach him.
I always teach him, like, hey, this is dangerous.
Yeah.
So that he doesn't, so that he stays away from it. And he's only seen me do it.
Yeah.
So he assumes it would be too dangerous for you, delicate Melissa.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you are, you know, like, you hurt yourself every time you do something in the yard. So.
Anyways, that is my little embarrassing story as we head into Exodus 16. Right. It has nothing to do with Exodus 16, no tie-in at all, but I just thought that'd be fun to share.
Yeah. All right. Well, awesome. So we're gonna transition now into Exodus 16. I wanted to go back to 15 and just kind of remind where we came from. Exodus 15, like I mentioned in the last podcast, probably the oldest section, you know, oldest written section of the Bible. So if you... it's like the oldest Hebrew that's in the scriptures, and probably the cornerstone of like their faith songs. You know, like whenever they think about where they came from and how their scriptures were developed, this is probably, you know, one of the first things that they remember that goes back, that all of the rest of the scriptures are built off of, is this moment. And so it's probably the oldest section in your Bible, and it's praising God for his power and his deliverance and what he's going to do for them. And one of the main lines, the part that's like looking forward, is verse 13. It's in your loyal love, you led the people whom you redeemed. In your strength, you guided them to the abode of your holiness. And we noted last time, I think, that in the story, that's not happened yet. He hasn't led them to the abode of his holiness. He's led them into the desert. You know, he's like led them across the, you know, across the sea on dry ground, into the desert. And this is a looking forward as if it has already happened, even though it hasn't happened in the narrative yet. There's two parts to it, I think. It's both a reflection on what happened. They sing this song even in the future. But it's also as if in the narrative that they have this trust that God's going to lead them in his loyal love. And that's that word hesed that we talked about in Ruth, and just God's, his unfailing love, his ability. Like he just seems to stick it out with them even whenever they don't deserve it. And so we haven't really seen that so yet, because they haven't gotten to that point. He has had loyal love for Abraham, because he's starting to fulfill his promises to him, even though Abraham's, you know, dead, that even after that, he's fulfilling his promises that he made, to the, you know, these forefathers, the ancestors of this group of people. So anyways, he's going to do that. That's kind of what the rest of this narrative is going to be, is this leading them in his loyal love, those who he has redeemed, to the abode of his holiness. And so that's really what the rest of the Bible is going to be about, is this redeemed people and going into the holiness, into his abode. And then after this like amazing song of praise, you have immediately this change in shift, like, or shift in their attitudes. Whenever they go 3 days in the desert, and they find water, but they can't drink it, and they cry out to God. And one thing to note right now that I don't think we brought up last week was that the water was not able to be, they couldn't drink it, which is kind of the same phrase that's used whenever the water of Egypt is turned to blood. And so it's kind of like this, they're playing on each other, and we're going to see more of that play in this next chapter of how the things that God did in Egypt as judgments, they're going to be the same thing, like they're going to be repeated here, but instead of being judgments, they're graces and they're blessings that are being poured out on Israel, even when they don't deserve it. And so you kind of have that duality of God where he's like this, the very same things that he does are one judgment for one people and blessings for another. It's all about the attitude, you know, that they have towards it. And so that's just there to be noted, and things to be pondered on. So they cry out to God, and then he has Moses throw down this piece of wood into the water. It becomes sweet, and they can drink it. And they end up encamped at this place that's just like this oasis, this paradise in the desert, where God is providing for them and continuing to show his loyal love despite their grumbling against him, their grumbling against Moses. So that's where we pick up. They're at Elim in the narrative, and there's like just all of this, you know, trees and water, 12 springs of water kind of thing. And now they're going to continue their trek. All right, so I am going to read, verses 1 through 16?
Yep.
Okay. And they set out from Elim, and all of the community of the Israelites came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. In the 15th day of the second month of their going out from the land of Egypt, and all the community of the Israelites grumbled against Moses and against Aaron in the desert. And the Israelites said to them, "Oh, if only we had died by the hand of Yahweh in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread until we were full, because you have brought us out of the desert to kill all of this assembly with hunger." And Yahweh said to Moses, "Look, I am going to rain down for you bread from the heavens, and the people will go out and gather enough for the day on its day. In that way, I will test them. Will they go according to my law or not? And then on the sixth day, they will prepare what they bring, and it will be twice over what they gather every other day." And Moses and Aaron said to all of the Israelites, "In the evening you will know that Yahweh has brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of Yahweh, for he hears your grumblings against Yahweh. And what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When in the evening Yahweh gives you the meat to eat and bread in the morning to fill up on, for he hears your grumblings that you grumble against him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against Yahweh." And Moses said to Aaron, "Say to all the community of the Israelites, come near before Yahweh, because he has heard your grumblings." And at the moment of Aaron speaking to all the community of the Israelites, they turned to the desert. And just then the glory of Yahweh appeared in a cloud. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "I have heard the grumblings of the Israelites. Speak to them, saying, 'At twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be full with bread, and you will know that I am Yahweh your God.' And so it was in the evening, the quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, a layer of dew was all around the camp. And the layer of dew came up. And there on the face of the desert was a fine granular substance, fine like frost on the ground. And the Israelites saw, and they said to each other, 'What is this?' Because they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'That is the bread that Yahweh has given to you as food. This is the word that Yahweh commanded. Gather from it, each according to what he can eat, an omer per person according to the number of you. You each shall take enough for whoever is in his tent.'"
So we start out this chapter with kind of the timeline of this being the 15th day of the second month, so about 6 weeks after they had come out of Egypt. So that's a pretty short amount of time, really, mm-hmm. in my mind, for them to have a turn in their how they are viewing things, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah. Because to me, what this reminds me of is actually something that, and I didn't mention this before, but something that Harrison said during his yak story we used to do on Wednesday nights, of just like, you never know what's just around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always really stuck out to me, because I do think that our emotions about and our feelings about things can change so quickly. That can be a very optimistic or hopeful thought if you're in kind of a dark place right now, of like, you never know if just next month you could be at the highest, you know, level of how you feel. I mean, I think you see that with work a lot. Yeah. Of just, you know, you're at a really hard time with something that you're working on, and not knowing what's just around the corner, where a month from now you may feel great about work.
Yeah.
You know, you might get, you know, you might have a good meeting. You might have praise from your boss. You just never know kind of how you're going to be feeling about it month to month. And I kind of, it kind of helps me to resonate with the Israelites when I think about it that way, of just how, yeah, emotionally, month to month, I'm probably in a very, you know,
yeah, I mean, I think
we're state.
Yeah, we're very cyclical in that. I think we just we have a hard time whenever you're in the midst of a problem,
mm-hmm,
to remember the past and to remember where you've come from and to remember, yeah, how, dude, just last week it was great. You know, like, why, right, can't you think about how that was? And instead of being concentrating on the problem, you know, I guess just for the sake of the problem, with what's right in front of you, and being, you know, frustrated with it, feeling like you're never going to get through it, and instead think about the past. And I think for me, where that takes me is whenever I left from one job to another, and I mean, that's probably been, what, like 7 or 8 years now?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I thought that I was going to be at that other job for a long time. And
I thought he was going to, like, retire from that job.
I know. I thought I was, too. And then one day it was just like, hey, you know, we can't have you anymore. We can't support you anymore. You're going to have to find something else to do. And that was really shocking because I thought it was like, I mean, I was doing a great job and, mm-hmm, all this stuff, and, like, just completely blindsided me. And, you know, but they gave me like 2 months to kind of work out, like, how to transition and stuff like that. And, so I started putting my, you know, resume out there, whatnot. And, another job, you know, another place that was in town came and picked me up and they said, hey, you know, when can you start? And I was like, well, I mean, whenever you want me to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was still working at the previous place, and, you know, because, like I said, they had kind of given me some time to work it out, and I went and told them. I was like, hey, I'm ready to leave, and they were trying to work out other things for me.
Yeah,
but it was going to be that I would have to move to another power plant, and work for them instead, but I mean, I was just like, hey, I'm ready to be done right now. Can we set this up? And so I did my exit interview and stuff on a Friday, and I started a new company on a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought that I would never be able, like, I kind of got in that, like, in a mode of like, well, this is what I do. How can I ever do anything else? Like, mm-hmm, how would anybody ever want me? Whenever I feel like I had been like, I felt like I was kind of niche in that, you know, how can I take this experience, you know, with turbine systems and turn that into, like, who else is going to want that sort of expertise? And basically the thing that I was doing was exactly what this new company wanted and needed help with. And it was like, what the heck, you know? And it was right here, like, it was right down the street, you know, from where I worked previously. And so, you know, it was a huge blessing. And I remember kind of walking around after that. I would walk at lunch and just kind of reflecting on, like, wow, you know, like, God's provision for me, and kind of this song of praise that you see in chapter 15, that's kind of how I felt. You know, it was like God had brought me through something that I was afraid that I'd never, like, I was like, how am I going to recover from this kind of thing? And yet it just, he made it so easy. And so, like, I remember that. And then, but then, you know, you kind of get a few years down the road and you start forgetting God's provision.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I mean, I think it's highlighted just how short of a time it is, but it's part of the human condition. I feel like that we just, you know, we get so far down the road, or we hit opposition and we feel like God's not with us.
Yeah.
And that's how they feel as they go out into the desert. I mean, they're in the desert. I mean, let's not forget that they're in the desert, and they leave, and it does take faith. I mean, they're taking a step to leave this oasis, you know, like, it would be easy to just kind of hang out at the oasis. You know, there's 70 trees and 12 springs of water. Like, why not just, let's just hang out here for forever. It seems, mm-hmm, like there's plenty of life here.
Yeah.
It would have been easy to do that, but they do step out on faith, I suppose, and follow Moses continuing into the desert. And then they get hungry.
Yeah.
But whenever that hunger sets in, it's really hard to think about anything else. I mean, I think in our society, we don't really know what it is to be hungry. You know, will say I'm hungry or I'm starving or whatever, but that's not even close to what real hunger would feel like.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have ever experienced anything like that, like actual hunger.
Right.
And so let's not think too badly of them. Instead, let's reflect on it and say, like, I am this way. Maybe don't think of it from a hunger standpoint. Think of it from like a school standpoint or from your work standpoint. Are you afraid of that stuff? Are you afraid that, well, if I didn't have this, then what would I have? And that's kind of where they are. They've relied on Egypt for their provision. And now that it's having to come from somewhere else, they're starting to freak out.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, Egypt wasn't that great for them. they were slaves.
It feels like they're vastly misremembering the situation.
Yeah, I mean, verse 3, you know, it sounds a lot like what happened right before the Red Sea,
mm-hmm.
when they were in between. They see the Egyptians coming and they're standing there waiting, you know, like they're standing there at the Red Sea, like, we've got nowhere to go. And they're asking the exact same question of, like, we should have just died in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Why are we out here? And so they're asking the same question again. And then to add on to that, they're saying there were pots of meat. There was this abundance of food in Egypt and we could just sit around and eat whatever we wanted. And it's like, don't you remember, though, when you were crying out to God in Egypt that you wanted to be free of this slavery?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have two very different pictures of what their time in Egypt was like from a few chapters ago when they are just miserable there to now them saying, oh, we got to eat whatever we wanted and however much we wanted. And it's like, you're, like you said, you're misremembering the situation.
Right. And so they're learning. I mean, God's brought them out into the desert. He's given them freedom. You know, he is their king in this instance. So it's not like they've just gone out from Pharaoh and now they're serving nobody. I mean, they were coming out to serve Yahweh. And it's kind of a juxtaposition of these two kings. But I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, he's given them this freedoms from slavery, but it's almost like they would rather the slavery with maybe some of the things that came with it than freedom and having nothing. And, you know, I think he's trying to teach them to, like, you have to change. You have to change, like, how you operate. And the slavery of Egypt is still built into them.
Mm-hmm.
It's still part of who they are. And he's got to get that, you know, get that worked out of them. This is what Carmen Joy Imes writes about in her book, Bearing God's Name. This is kind of at the beginning. As she starts her book at leaving Egypt and going to Sinai. She really wants to highlight the Sinai story because that's, people don't know that story, and that's what we're going to do. But this is her quote, like, considering going into the wilderness here. It says, for Israel, the wilderness journey from Egypt to Canaan is liminal space. That is the space in between, right? When you're not quite one thing and you haven't become quite another. Far more than just a place to pass through, it is the workshop of Israel's becoming. The wilderness is the temporary destination that makes them who they are. Liminal spaces always do this. They change us. The Israelites have been liberated from slavery in Egypt, but they have not yet arrived at their final destination. Everything they know about who they are, how to survive, and what is expected of them is stripped away on that fateful night when they make their escape, leaving them vulnerable and uncertain. They don't know how to live under these new arrangements, but God is not in a hurry to lead them out of the liminal space into the land that he promised to give them. They are not ready yet. Into this vacuum, Yahweh speaks. He answers the basic questions of human existence in surprising new ways, offering himself as the solution to their needs for leadership, guidance, protection, and provision, and revealing his name as the key to their identity and vocation as his people. Yahweh invites them to begin walking in a new direction by trusting him. Sinai is part of their liminal experience. In the wilderness of Sinai, they are free from the mind-numbing distractions of Egypt and Canaan. In their isolation, they can hear the voice of God. Having lost their old identity, they are ready to become what they are meant to be. And so I want, as we read these, you know, this narrative, I want to hear that in that. You know, it's, God is forming his people. He's changing them into the people that he wants them to be. And part of that is he has to strip everything away from them so they can show what real, he can show what really matters. And that is that I Yahweh, provide your everything that you need. I am the one who you need to look to for your provision. And I think that's what he's going to do in this narrative. Like, he's patient with them. They cry out, and they misremember Egypt. And yet, you know, you read the narrative and it says what, like, you know, they complain and they grumble. And it says, and Yahweh said to Moses, look, I am going to rain down. And if you stop there and you think about and you're reflect,
like, uh-oh. Uh-oh. Yeah.
If you reflect on the way that we normally view the Old Testament God, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we think, oh, he's full of vengeance and, you know, scary. Malice.
He's going to be angry.
Yeah, stomping, temper tantrum throwing God, right? If we import that into this text, you could read, look, I am going to rain down. And if I stop there, you would assume fire from heaven, mm-hmm. right? And that's just not what he says. He says, look, I'm going to rain down for you bread from the heavens. And the people will go out and they'll gather enough for the day on its day. And so his response to the people's grumbling isn't judgment. And it's the same words that are used for he rained down hail on the Egyptians. So he's going to rain down hail on the Egyptians. But for the Israelites, his response is something different, and that he's going to rain down bread from heaven, and he provides them for what they need. He gives them what they need in the desert.
And honestly, this response goes very much against how, like, I would respond to the uh-huh. Israelites. I know that if Caleb were to be complaining like this, that my response wouldn't be to provide him with more blessings.
Yeah.
I would probably have a few words for Caleb that, you know, might be like the angry mom coming out in me.
Yeah.
So this is that, that's what makes this even more special, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he just has a totally different response as to what you would think to such grumbling. And he rains down blessing on them. And I think that's just incredible and something just totally against what we thought that he would do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this idea of the test. So he says that in this way, I will test them. So what were your thoughts on the testing?
Well, I kind of struggled with this. I think when I see, testing somebody, I feel like it's kind of a negative thing. It's hard for me to take this in a positive way. I start to think about temptation, and I kind of struggle with, is God tempting them with like excess amounts of food on the ground and then telling them don't take it, but it's, you know, it's there, but don't take it because I'm testing you. And I'm like, well, he's providing that. So in some way, is he tempting them with it? But I think what helped me the most to kind of sort through this was comparing this to Adam and Eve
mm-hmm.
and in the garden, and how they are essentially, I've never really considered them to be tempted by the tree or tempted by God.
Right.
Towards the tree of
knowledge of good and evil.
Right. Yeah. And so when I think about this in that same way, I'm like, God's not really tempting them. It really is like you have an opportunity to choose these instructions.
Yeah.
And you can or you can't, you know, like, I mean, you get to decide.
Yeah.
There's no indication here of like, if you don't follow this, you're going to die.
Yeah. I'm going to punish you. But,
right. But yeah. I mean,
yeah. And, with the tree of knowing good and evil, there's definitely this this sense of, hey, if you eat from this tree, and what it says in the text is that you will die. And that's where, whenever you see it translated certainly die, that's where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever Eve requotes it, she just says die, and then she also adds it, and you shall not touch it. So she adds something to it, and she takes something away. She takes away the seriousness of the consequences, and she also adds further to it, which I think G.K. Beale says, notes that she's the first legalist in the Bible. He's like, so she adds more to it to make sure that you won't ever eat from it. But ultimately, the tree of knowing good and evil is a moment of a choice. It symbolizes a choice.
Mm-hmm.
In the, am I going to listen to the voice of Yahweh, or am I going to listen to the voice of this other thing that's in the garden? That's actually that they're supposed to rule over. They're supposed to rule over the beast, and then there's this beast in the garden, and they're supposed to, as the priests of God's dwelling place that is Eden, Adam and Eve, they're supposed to cast that thing out and say, "You don't belong here. Go." And instead, they listen to the voice and they assume that God is holding out on them. That if I do this, I'll be like God and then have his thing. Which the sad part of the whole matter is that they already are like God. They've already been made in his image, and yet they can't see it and they won't see it. Instead, they think that God is holding out on them, and it represents a choice. And every time that happens in the scriptures, it's every time there's something, a choice placed in front of them, do this or don't do this, that Yahweh gives them some command or some law, it's an opportunity to either lean into God and trust in his word and trust in who he is as a, you know, as this divine being that has created all of the world, and mm-hmm. and trusting him that he has your best interest in heart, or saying, no, I think I have the best path here for myself. You don't know what I need. And I think that's what's happening. And so whenever he says that I'm going to test them here in this text, it's an opportunity to lean into God and trust in his provision, and to come to know him more deeply. And I think that's the purpose of his whole testing. It's an opportunity to choose the tree of life, which is God's voice, over the tree of knowing good and evil, which is our own voice, or the voice of the serpent, you know, mm-hmm. the voice of this other being of which we're supposed, that created thing, the voice of this created thing. And so I think that's the choice that they're faced with here. It's like, listen to my Torah, listen to my law or not,
mm-hmm.
but which is going to bring life? It's going to be listening to God's instruction, and trusting not in your wisdom, but in his wisdom.
Yeah. And I think, Garrett, you know, usually reads second. I usually read first. And the reason, hold on just a second. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted him to read first was because I really liked his version. What version are you reading from?
It's the Lexham English Bible. So it comes with the Faith Life Study or the Logos Bible software.
Okay. So. And then I'm just reading from the NIV. And so mine says, "In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions." And Garrett's says, "Will they go according to my law or not?" And when he read his version the other day, I just, "Will they go according to my law or not?" just sort of helped me in my head sort through this, and just hearing it in a different way, which is, I think, a cool thing that we do have two different versions, because we're able to kind of see where they differ.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of talked a little bit about this, "Will they go according to my law or not?" of kind of being a, "Will they walk with me or not?"
Yeah.
And that goes back to the garden. You know, are they going to walk with God in the garden, or are they going to choose a different way?
Yeah. And I got that from the Go. The background behind that, I believe. Yeah. The Go is walk. Will they walk according to my law or not? And then if you go back, that's what God does whenever he walks in the garden, and also whenever Enoch walks with Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I kind of made that tie of like, oh, you know, it's kind of like walking according to his word, you know, yeah. walking with him and, you know, and listening to the voice of Yahweh.
Yeah.
And so this is going to happen so many times in scripture. It's like, you're going to be faced with a choice. Am I going to listen to the wisdom of Yahweh, or am I going to do this other thing? And I mean, Solomon's faced with that choice. We think about Solomon and we're like, oh, you know, he was so awesome to ask for wisdom. Like, how awesome is that? But the problem is that he has the wisdom. He has the knowledge of God. And then he chooses to do other things.
Yeah.
He chooses his own wisdom over God's wisdom, you know, time and time again. He amasses wives and, you know, and it's like, okay, I can go to the Torah and see, like, hey, kings weren't supposed to amass wives. And so he chooses his own way. And it's not that he doesn't know, not that he doesn't have it. He just chooses not to follow it. And just the same, it's like here, you know, God's trying to teach them and seeing if they're going to listen to the voice or not. And he's going to teach them in the desert, and he's going to have patience with them as they don't, whenever they don't listen. Because that's going to be the ultimate story of Israel, is they don't listen to Yahweh's voice.
Yeah.
And how does that go? You know, what ends up happening with that? Yeah. So the choice is going to be as to what they do with the bread from heaven, right? Do they collect just enough for day to day and trust in God's provision from day to day, or do they try to hoard it and say, well, I don't know if there's going to be manna tomorrow. So, or the, what is this? They still haven't called it manna. They say manu, which is what is this? And then it gets called manna based off of that. But, so, you know, like they don't know if it's going to happen from day to day. This is the first time we've seen it. Seems to fill our bellies. You know, we should keep it, right? Like we should collect as much of it as we can. That seems like a normal human thing to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I think about going to my Enneagram, you can look that up online, personality tests and stuff. I'm a six, and one of the things that sixes value is security.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this would be something that I would very much struggle with, of just wanting to plan for the future, I guess, and making sure that me and my family had enough. And if like there was plenty there, it would be hard for me to just be like, okay, just take for today because God's going to provide for tomorrow, and really trusting that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just a difficult.
Yeah, this seems very, this would be really hard for us to live up to, I think. You know, like that's the idea of just being like, so can you imagine giving up everything? And then all of a sudden, you know, and like saying, we're just going to live day to day. And, you know, I don't know. I kind of see that as something that the first century church kind of does, and how they respond to it. And maybe there's something to be said there of like how much we trust and how much we amass and how much we bring and, you know, put essentially in our storehouses, you know, that are banks, whatever. And maybe there's something there to challenge us of like, are we giving ourselves the opportunity to lean into God and to say like, I'm going to trust in your provision instead of my own plannings and my own schemings. I mean, these are the things that Jesus would talk about and James would talk about, is saying like, hey, you know, you brag about, I'm going to be at this town or that town, you know, at so many months. He's like, why are you worried about so far into the future? You know, like we need to be worried about, you know, be concerned about day to day stuff, and instead of, you know, putting your hope in what you're saving for the future. And so I don't know. I can see where there'd be a lot of struggle with something like that. But I want to make sure that we're not just ignoring this because it wouldn't fit our culture, like of how we want to do things.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like, you know, like when you strip all of that stuff away, again, it's just that opportunity to lean into God. And you know, like if there's a chance for us to grow deeper, like maybe we should do something to make that happen, you know, like put our trust in God in some way with this stuff. And I don't know, I find that pretty challenging as a planner and somebody that likes to have things laid out. For future, because I'm even worried about like, you know, I'm like worried about next year. I mean, so these people are worried about day to day, you know, you can't be too hard on them. So they go, they're going to gather, daily. And it says that, I mean, I guess one thing to note is that they recognize that, the grumbling isn't against Moses, but it's actually against Yahweh. Right. They're not grumbling against Moses. They're grumbling against Yahweh because they don't trust that he's going to provide for them.
And I love that Moses calls them out on that,
mm-hmm.
Because to me, it's like they don't want to see themselves as grumbling against God. I think it's easier for them because they know what he's capable of.
Yeah.
I think it's easier in their minds to just be like, Moses, this is on you and Aaron.
Yeah.
And so for Moses to kind of really point out, no, your ultimate trust issues is that you don't trust that God's going to take care of you. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably a pretty humbling moment for them.
Yeah. And so he invites them in verse 9, even in their grumbling, it says, come near before Yahweh because he has heard your grumbling. So even in their complaining, Yahweh is in your Moses. Yahweh through Moses, through Aaron, is inviting them to come near to Yahweh, which is what Yahweh wants. He wants for his people to draw near to him and find that trust in him. And whenever he says that, they turn around and then the glory of Yahweh appears in the cloud. Like how, you know, just amazing that scene must be. And he speaks to them, or speaks to Moses through the cloud, and that the quail is going to come up and the bread is going to come down. What's interesting, verse 13, it says, and so it was in the evening, the quail came up and it covered the camp. And so these are the same words that are used for the locust in the Exodus story, that they came up and they covered it. And it, you know, it settles down on the camp. And instead of it destroying life, like the locust did, it's a provision for life for them to continue to, be sustained in the desert. And then on the next morning, the manna appears and they say, what is this? And I just imagine like the provision of God. And, the way that I think about it is like me coming downstairs at dinner time. And then like, if you fix something new and I just look into it, I'm like, what is this? Like that would have to be a total letdown. Like for you, you have like, I've worked really hard on this and I'm providing, you know, providing food for you in the evening. Like, can't you show some excitement about trying something new?
Especially if you had been complaining about not having anything to eat.
Yeah. If like, I've never had any, like, we never do anything new, you know, or, and then you do something new and I'm like, what is this? I kind of, that feels like the tone.
Yeah.
Of it, or just like not being impressed with the food that they're provided, but it's like food from, I mean, it's manna from heaven is the way that
it's hard to imagine this because it's thin flakes like frost.
Yeah.
Frosted flakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Frosted flakes. They eat frosted flakes in the desert.
And they were like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately with this, whenever they go, you know, they gather each day. I mean, it's going to be this test of what are they going to do with it? Are they going to trust God from day to day and eat what it is they need to or not? And so that seems to be the test that's in front of them that's going to pick up here in verse 17.
The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers, for each person, and the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. So they saved it until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is the Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where he is on the seventh day. No one is to go out. So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come." As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. The Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. An omer is 1/10 of an ephah.
Since everybody knows ephahs are.
Fun fact, ephah, we first saw that in Ruth.
Which she remembered. And can you remember how much it was? Oh, you were so smart just a second ago.
I know. You shouldn't ask any more questions. It was something, a bushel, like a third of a bushel.
Which everybody knows what a bushel is. Wasn't it like 22 liters or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I remember going, I was like hunting it down. I was like, I think we saw this in Ruth, because that would make sense with the grain and everything.
So 2.2 liters is an omer then? If it's a tenth of an ephah?
Yeah, it had said about 2 liters over on the last page, and then I think it's a little
so more, they got a really. 2-liter bottle of manna, you know, think about that.
Per day, per person.
Okay, so to kind of go back to this, again, they're faced with a choice, and what are they going to do? What do they choose to do with the choice? And answer, it seems like it starts out okay. They each just collect what they need.
I was like, way to go, guys.
Yeah, way to go. Like, you didn't hoard it. But it seems like it doesn't last very long. It's really not all that different from Genesis 1, 2, and 3. It's like, oh, it's all great. And then,
and then it's not.
Yeah. And so then it seems like they kind of start hoarding it to be like, well, you know, what if he doesn't provide tomorrow?
This goes back to, so what I would do is like, well, I'm not that hungry today. And like, what if there isn't any tomorrow? What's the harm in just keeping a little bit for tomorrow just in case?
Yeah.
And it's like, no.
Right. I mean,
that's not what I said to do.
Yeah, no, it just seems like God really wants them to learn how to trust him for their provision. That's what he's doing. And this whole worms and stank here just made us think of, if you've ever seen Lord of the Rings, the Uruk-hai, they are traveling with the hobbits, and they're like trying to, like, can we eat them? You know, like, what if they don't need their legs? You know, it's like, we haven't had anything but maggoty bread for three stinking days. And so the maggoty bread made us think of that, of what the Uruk-hai eat. And if you haven't watched Lord of the Rings, I will say it again, you need to. Everybody mm-hmm. needs to see the Lord of the Rings movies. But anyway, so it ends up being stanky, wormy bread, and they can't eat it, obviously, unless I guess they just want to eat worms, which I guess you could do.
They were desperate.
Yeah. And it melted in the sun when it was hot. But then it just kind of transitions to, like, this is just what they do. This is mm-hmm. how they started, you know, 6 days of gathering and 1 day of rest. And this is where the idea of Sabbath comes into play for the first time. And I think that this is, you know.
Well, sort of.
What? Like what?
I guess labeled maybe as Sabbath. I don't know. In Genesis, is it?
Okay. So elaborate on that.
So when God creates.
when God creates the heavens and the earth.
On the seventh day, he rested.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like he was taking the day to just enjoy.
Yeah.
Creation and admire creation.
Yeah, right? And the word Shabbat is to cease. He ceases from his work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says. And so the root word for Sabbath is that, and it's what's used there in chapter 1, or really beginning of chapter 2, I think, that he ceases from his work and he rests, right? And the idea there isn't that he takes a, you know, he's like, I'm tired and, you know, need to go to bed. It's that he's enjoying his creation,
mm-hmm.
And ruling and reigning over it, everything that he's created. And so that's the idea of it. It's not just like it's not a holy sleep. It's a resting over everything that he's done. And so that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to Shabbat, They're supposed to cease from their work. Another word that would get used with this to rest is the word noach, which is to settle. It's what the locusts do whenever they come and they settle on the ground, or even whenever the quail, you know, like they come and they like settle on the ground. It's this idea of they come in and they start munching, right? And they just like start doing their thing.
Yeah.
But anyways, with Israel, he says that I'm going to take you into the land so that you can have rest. And he's taking them, you know, to Canaan, and they're going to rule over, you know, whatever. It's the idea of this ruling and reigning whenever everything has been set right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what Sabbath is a reflection on that. And it's a reflection on God's provision. I think that's what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to gather on the Sabbath. Instead, they're supposed to reflect on, man, God provided double what we needed yesterday again. You know,
mm-hmm.
He did it again. He does it every 6 day. We get twice as much as what we need.
I think I kind of want to back up for a second, because I want to mention the fact that kind of what happened when they did disobey God.
Okay.
Because when they did disobey God, yes, there was a consequence in the sense of, you know, the stuff that they kept was ruined with maggots and started to smell. But God didn't stop providing. He didn't say, you disobeyed me, so I am not going to provide you this manna
mm-hmm.
and quail anymore. That, like, I'm done. You've disobeyed me yet again. Like, that wasn't the case. He didn't. In fact, it doesn't even, it says Moses was angry with them. I think we can probably assume that God wasn't super happy.
No.
Yeah.
Moses is his emissary.
Right.
You know.
Right. You know, Moses, I think it would be natural to be upset here. But we don't really have like a, like God rebuking them
mm-hmm.
moment. And I point that out because I think something we're starting to see here is the, do you want to say it? Hesed. You want to say it with
the little throat queer. Yeah. The Hesed where, of Yahweh.
Where you spit on everyone in the room.
Okay.
And what I think is really cool is that this chapter did, because I guess of the grain and the ephah and everything, reminded me of Ruth,
mm-hmm.
which Ruth is like the epitome of where you're seeing that hesed, that loving kindness. And so you're seeing, I think I don't know. I don't want to say necessarily the first times, but this is really God putting that loving kindness, that faithfulness to his people into action, that where we're seeing that in a different way, in a way that's not punishments, to the enemy.
Yeah, and now he does, I mean, it does seem like for whatever reason, the bread, you know, becomes maggoty, you know, so there's some aspect of that of being like, I'm going to take that away from you because you need to learn how to, that I'm going to provide for you. It's like a kid who's been given the car keys for the first time. And you're like, hey, I'm trusting you with this. Like, listen to, be home at 10, you know? And then the kid gets home at 10:30. And you say, listen, dude, I told you 10:30. And so now I'm taking the keys from you. You know, it's not that, like, you're doing that, not with the being like, well, I'm just going to punish you forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, listen, there's a consequence to this. And if at some point you're going to give them back and then, you know, see if that consequence is like, learn, you know, if they've learned anything from it. And I think for this, it's just that, the bread ends up maggoty so that they can learn again, be like, God provided today again. And as it happens over and over and over again, they start to be like, man, you know, this does, like, this is just normal.
Yeah.
You know, this is just life living with Yahweh.
Yeah.
That he's providing life in the desert.
Yeah.
And that trust. So seventh day, they're reflecting on how God provided twice what they needed the day before and how awesome that is. And it's kind of like that the Sabbath day is supposed to, I think, supposed to represent, them living, in the truth that God reigns and that he's king over all of it. And reflecting on God's kingship and how he is their provider, and they don't need anything else because of who he is. That's what the Sabbath day was going to continually be for them. The way that it'll be in the tabernacle is that every seventh day, the priest will take in the showbread, which there's 12 loaves of the showbread that goes into the tabernacle. And that bread would bask in the light of the lamp, the menorah tree. So the menorah tree's got seven lights on it, and those lights would shine on the showbread. And what that was reflecting on is Israel basking in the light of Yahweh every seventh day, and you know, just being filled with His presence, and how you know He was continually providing for them, and it's bread. You know, they're represented by bread. And so there's probably a lot of different things that you could probably tie into it. But ultimately, the Sabbath rest is supposed to be kind of recognizing, yeah, we're in the desert, but God is our provider. And even whenever they would get into Babylon, you know, that idea of the seventh day rest is kind of a reflection and being like, maybe Babylon rules right now, but God's king of it all, and He's going to provide for us. And that's kind of the trust that they would hope in, and why the Sabbath was so important to them. And you know what they're supposed to do here. I mean, they're commanded to do it and to observe it and to keep it. And there's going to be more filled out.
And again, yeah. Like, I think we've mentioned this in a previous podcast, of that the Sabbath like can feel restrictive, but I love seeing in verse 29, bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. That this is a gift that they are able to rest and reflect on God's goodness. And they didn't have a day to rest in Egypt.
That's right.
You know, and that gets back to what you're saying of kind of this upside down kingdom, where before they were having to basically provide for the king, and the king is providing for the people.
That's right.
And so it's just this really cool moment, and when you kind of are able to see it this way, you're able to realize this is not something to be like restrictive of like, you can't do anything on this day. It's more of a like, aren't you like, be thankful for this opportunity to reflect.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was really neat.
Yeah. And I think this narrative is supposed to be playing off of Exodus chapter 5. So Exodus chapter 5 is whenever Moses goes to Pharaoh for the first time, and Pharaoh says, you want them to cease from their work. You're lazy. You know, he's kind of pointing out to him, like, you're lazy, your people are lazy, you just want them to stop working. So he drives them even harder, makes them make brick without straw. And so this same word is this rest that you see here. Verse 30, and the people rested on the seventh day. And so, yeah, it's the juxtaposition of these two kings. One king is providing for them, the other king, they are providing for him, you know, and how that has flipped on, you know, upside down. Underneath the kingship of Yahweh, He is the provider. He's the one that's supporting them, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think that those are definitely playing off of each other. I love this description of the manna. Whenever you talk about honey, something tasting like honey, it tasted like a wafer with honey. To me, I wonder if this is kind of like a foretaste of things to come, of their future hope that is the, you know, to be in the land filled with milk and honey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a foretaste. It's a God's provision for them, tastes like that which they're going to enter into, you know, at the end of this story, whenever I got to the end of this, with the manna, in verse 35, and it says the Israelites ate the manna for 40 years until they're coming into the inhabited land. They ate the manna until they're coming to the border of the land of Canaan. And I was just like, wait a second, right here in the middle of the narrative, we just had a spoiler as to how all this goes.
Yeah.
Whoa. Like, dadgummit, you should have said spoiler alert before you got to this.
Yeah.
That if you don't know the end of the story, well, there you go. It's ruined. It's going to take 40 years for them to get there. But they have manna in the desert during that time, and it's a foretaste of the promise that God has given His people, that He's going to take them to the land. That's not ultimately what they need. They don't need Canaan. What they need is Yahweh, and they need to be in His presence, even if that's in the desert. We need to take Yahweh in the desert over no Yahweh in Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they want to, Yahweh wants them to start associating all of these things with him so that whenever they get into Canaan, they can be thankful and that they can remember how Yahweh provided, that it wasn't just because, well, we were a big group of people and we came and took Canaan.
Yeah.
Right. Instead it's Yahweh provided for us 40 years in the desert, 40 years we lived in the desert and he provided for us every day. And I think it's tying that provision with him, so that whenever they go into the land, they don't get full of themselves and they remember who their God is. I think that's the whole point. I think that's what he's trying to do with them and shape them and get them out of their slavery, but also get them started, getting them to live like a new humanity, something that's different than everything that's around them.
I also think it's really cool how they take this one jar. And they're keeping it as a, they're not going to eat it. They're just keeping it as a reminder to show future generations of what God has done for them and how he is delivering them and providing for them along the way.
Yeah.
And another kind of interesting thing is I remember reading this for the first time and being like, put the manna in front of the testimony, capital T testimony in mind. And I was like, what is that? So would you like to kind
of... Well, it's just it's the Ark of the Testimony. So they're going to put it in the Holy of Holies. And it's going to be a reminder of where they came from.
So this is kind of jumping forward then of like when this happened, I guess, that they did that. But
Yeah, because they can't put it before the Ark of the Testimony whenever there's no Ark yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of what I was getting at with that, is that this is also kind of... It's a little bit confusing in the timeline of... when all this is happening, I guess. But yeah, I thought that was something that was really cool. And I asked Garrett the question, like, is there anything that we do that would be kind of similar to this, of like having a keepsake on your, mm-hmm. on your mantle or something. And, the closest thing that we could think of is really like the Lord's Supper.
Right. I mean, and that's what we do for remembrance of where we've come from. Right. I mean, and it ties with Passover, and, you know, I think that's one tie for it. I would say that we probably don't do enough of this type of thing, where, you know, this isn't necessarily like a commemorative, you know, feast, like Passover was, or like the Lord's Supper is. Yeah. This is kind of like what you were talking about with the rocks, you know?
Okay. So yeah. So for the past few years, we've gone up to a cabin in the mountains, and for the past 2 years, one activity that we've done with the kids is, this mining thing. It's really neat. They end up with a bunch of really cool, I'll call them rocks, but they're different kinds of, I guess, minerals and, I took geology in college and I'm like, yeah, I kind of remember this.
It rocked.
But it rocked.
Yeah.
You got to have a geology joke if you mention it. And so, you know, they come home with this bag of really cool, different color rocks. And it's kind of like, okay, what do we do with this? And so I decided to put them in a mason jar and keep them on our mantle so you can see kind of all the cool different color rocks. And for me, seeing that jar on the mantle represents more than just that one mining experience. It represents that weekend as a family that we had at a cabin creating memorable experiences. And I'm hoping that as Caleb and Sadie get older, that they'll look to the mantle and they'll see these, you know, jars of rocks and think about these memories that we've mm-hmm. created together. And so that's kind of what I thought of when I was reading this. And I kind of wish we had something. I mean, that's obviously very meaningful for our family. But I think as far as God's faithfulness over, like, in a bigger picture, that it would be really cool to have something like that.
Yeah.
Visible in our home all the time.
Yeah. But ultimately, from a, you know, our liturgical perspective of like what we do that would emulate that, I would say it has to be the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
And so there's reasons for that. That I would say that. And I started reflecting on this and I was like, you know, there's gotta be a lot of ties that I'm just not, you know, I'm not thinking about whenever we first read this. Mm-hmm. I was like, there's gotta be something. And it occurred to me yesterday, I was like, this was way more obvious than I thought. I mean, one of the main miracles of Jesus that we can think about is the feeding of the 5,000 or of the 4,000. Mm. Either one. I think Mark records two different ones, which is pointed for what happens. But I think all of them, all four Gospels repeat, have some form of the 5,000. And what God leads them, or God, well, it is God. You know, Jesus is going out like to this desolate place, and you know, they're desperate for him. You know, they're like wanting his teaching and his healing and all of this stuff. And he leads them out to this desolate place. And the disciples are like, hey, you should send them home or go to the town so that they can have food. And he's like, what do you mean? Like, why don't you feed them? And they look at him like, you're crazy. And so the answer, what they end up doing is they bring him bread and fish, right? 5 loaves and 2 fish. And he blesses it. He tells the people to recline. And he took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he distributed it to those who were reclining, and likewise also the fish, as much as they wanted. And they were satisfied. They were filled up, just like the story. Just like the story that we're reading in Exodus 16. The bread, you know, they're filled up with the bread and the meat. And so they're filled up, and then they gathered the rest, and there was more left over than what they needed. Right. Mm-hmm. And so just the same, it was like everything that they needed, they were satisfied with Yahweh in 16. And then so whenever John is telling the story, this has to be on his mind. It has to be, in that he leads them out to the desert. He feeds them in the desert. OK, so this is chapter 6, by the way, that I'm reading. And then Jesus walks on the water. So as if it's dry ground. And so that, I think there's something, you know, something there. But then there's this discourse where they go over to Capernaum at the end of chapter 6. And the people are desperate for him. They were fed in the desert, and now they're looking for him. And then whenever they get to Capernaum and they find him, they found him on the other side of the sea. And they said to him, Rabbi, when did you get here? And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate the loaves and were satisfied. You were filled up. Do not work for the food that perishes, but the food that remains to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For God the Father has set his seal on this one. So they said to him, what shall we do that we can accomplish the works of God? And Jesus answered and said to them, this is the work of God, that you believe in the one whom that one sent. So they said to him, then what is the sign that you will perform? And he tells them, what is the sign that you perform so that we can see it and believe you? What will you do? Our fathers ate manna in the wilderness, just as it is written, he gave them bread to eat, or bread from heaven to eat. This is a direct quote from Exodus 16. Mm-hmm. And he says, truly, truly, I say to you, Moses did not give you bread from heaven, but my Father is giving you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is the one who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. So they said to him, sir, always give us this bread. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. The one who comes to me will never be hungry, and the one who believes in me will never be thirsty again. But I said to you, that you have seen me and do not believe. Everyone whom the Father gives to me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will never throw out, because I have come down from heaven. Not that I should do my will, but the will of the one who sent me. Now this is the will of the one who sent me, that everyone whom he has given me, I would not lose any of them, but raise them up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who looks on the Son and believes in him would have eternal life, and will raise him up on the last day. And then the Jews grumble. It says, and now the Jews began to grumble about him in the desert. Let's say Capernaum, but you know, like, okay, these have to be firing mm-hmm. for us. They grumble about him because he said, I'm the bread that comes down from heaven. And they were saying, Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know How does he say, I have come down from heaven? And Jesus answered, don't grumble among yourselves. No one is able to come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. And then he goes on to say, in 47, truly, truly, I say to you, the one who believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven so that someone may eat from it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats from this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. Man, that's a controversial thing to say, that the bread of life is my flesh. So the Jews began to quarrel among themselves, saying, how can this man give his flesh to eat? Then Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you do not have life in yourselves. The one who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. For my flesh is the true food, and my blood is the true drink. The one who eats my flesh and drinks my blood resides in me and I in them. Just as the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so also does the one who eats me. That one will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Not as the fathers ate and died, the one who eats this bread will live forever. And I know that was a lot to read, but holy moly. All of that. If you don't know Exodus 16, you can't get that.
Yeah. It adds so much more meaning.
Yeah. I mean he's filling all this stuff out of like this was the foretaste. This 16 was the foretaste of the things to come. And John doesn't give a story of the Lord's Supper. He's the only gospel that doesn't do that. But he tells it right here. Tells the same story that the other guys say. You know, like, he wanted to give it in a different place and a different meaning. Not necessarily a different meaning, but in a different part of the story to emphasize its point and its value. And it's like, man, Jesus is the provision from God. That through him, that we're going to be, I mean, he's the true bread from heaven. Whenever you think about the bread from heaven, he's saying, think about me. Think about what I'm doing. You know, I'm giving you manna in the desert. I am the manna in the desert. And if you want to have eternal life, if you want to live, if you want that restoration, you've got to find it in me. I'm the one that's bringing it. And so I think all of these things have to be playing off of each other. And I just love that. I mean, whenever there's so much more understanding about what he's getting at whenever we do that.